he actually bases it much more on Moorcock.
Half my setting is just Coomer nationalism.
So creativity is stored in the balls?
This is why manspreading is important. It's convective.
Is that what you want to be known as? The cold ball guy?
There are two types of men in this world, cold ballers and hot ballers.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to Little Wars in High Definition. I don't care how much your home gym cost, because my fetter and copy of Lichtenauer were probably cheaper. So, how you guys doing? Content drought, trying to end it. It's been a busy time. I had to buy an audio setup.
What's your name, strange sir?
Oh, I'm Mongoose Kikimura, and with me as always is my trusty buddy, Jack Carinette. Yo, buddy. Still alive?
Surprisingly, after the wedding, yes, I am still alive. She hasn't killed me yet.
Based.
Jack met and married his monster girl waifu from his dreams.
It was so beautiful. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was a it was a very nice ceremony. And yeah, we're all very happy for our boy here. So congratulations. That's one of the many things that happened between the last time you listened to our autism and this time. And with me...
And I'm John.
Yeah, I was about to introduce you.
Yeah, no, we had a fun meetup. We had the first practice for LittleCon, and that was a lot of fun.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
We were thinking about possibly recording some things live, and then we just got distracted by all the festivities, and we wound up just not recording anything. So.
Also, you know...
Sorry about that.
Portable audio setups.
Yeah.
Yeah, not really the best quality.
Not great. Also, Mongoose tried to read to me the Dune book.
And
as
he
we
hated
were driving.
It.
That was so awful. Holy crap.
I quite liked the parts
put
I
up
read.
With that?
I liked the parts I read. They were good.
It was like a parody of terrible sci-fi writing.
No.
Like, let's see how many fake words
no.
we can smush
no.
into this
no.
book.
No.
Were there any younglings?
No,
it was
like
even
that.
Worse than younglings. It was like fake Arabic words.
Yeah, those were places and setting and organizations. It made it feel like a real world and with people that were real.
It was like a Robot Chicken sketch of a bad writer and how many nonsense words you can shove into something.
Never say Chicken in my presence ever again. I will have you know that is haram.
You read out the Audio Chicken audiobook. I don't know what
the
to tell
audio
you.
Chicken audiobook?
Yeah,
what?
The audio robot chicken
listen,
book, yes.
I fully expect
that the commenters will agree with me, as always, like they do with the Yoda bit and all of the other quality things and opinions we give out here.
Yeah, of course.
Listen, yeah, because Dune is good. You're just wrong. I'm sorry.
Jack's lines matter.
Damn
shut
it.
Up.
There really is no... There for made up words and phrases, there really is no substitute for the king, which is Clockwork Orange. Have you guys ever read that book?
No, I haven't.
No.
Illuminate us,
sir. Oh boy. Let me see if I can find a I'll see if I can find an excerpt.
All right.
Well, have you read Dune, Jack?
I've read parts of it. I've had the book in my library for a while now, and yeah. It's a slog.
I'm actually borrowing a physical copy from friend of the show, Denver.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But yeah, the book just has a glossary at the end where you have to go through all of these made-up words that is just like two or three made-up words per sentence at the first part of the thing. And it's like, yeah, I get it. The guy in setting is also new to this, so they're trying to do like the audience analog, where it's like, you know, the new person who doesn't know the setting either, so he's like repeating all these words in his head that he doesn't know either. But that doesn't excuse the fact that you made up so many words. If you're such a good writer, use actual words.
Full disclosure, right. John quit after 5 pages. I think it was less than that.
I got that far? I got, yeah,
no,
I didn't
you,
think I got
no, you
that
got
far.
Like 3 pages in. I'm sorry. It was three
yeah,
pages.
It was obnoxious.
Let me give you a few sentences then from the king itself.
Okay.
The Luna was well up now, and we could vidy this cottage fine and clear as I eased up and put the brake on. The other three giggling like Bazoomni, and we could vidy the name on the gate of the cottage. Vesh was home, a gloomy sort of name. I got out of the auto. ordering my droogs to shush their giggles and act like serious. And I opened the Malenki gate and walked up to the front door. I knocked nice and gentle, what? And nobody came. So I knocked a little more this time, and I could slushly somebody coming, then a Boltron, then the door inched open an inch or so. Then I could vidy this one glass looking out at me, and the door was on a chain. Yes, who is it? Was the Sharp's galosh. A youngish Devaksha by her sound. So I said in a very refined manner of speech, a real gentleman's galosh. Pardon, madame, most sorry to disturb you, but my friend and me were out for a walk, and my friend was taken back by all the sudden and very troublesome turn, and he is out here on the road, dead out and groaning. Would you have the goodness to let me use your telephone to telephone for an ambulance?
That's terrible.
That is imminently that really cursed. Is terrible. That is like the most cursed thing I've heard in a long ass time.
Although, what was that first fake word? The B one. It almost sounded like Behimni.
Oh, Bazoomni. No. Not
Bazoomni?
Bazoomni. Giggling Bazoomni like Bazoomni. So it's in lowercase. So that's the other thing, is that some of these words are in uppercase and some of them are in lowercase. So,
oh my God.
But as
this
read
sounds
the book,
like
though,
somebody like was like, I'm going to give you $20 to invent a white people version of Ebonics.
It just sounds like the chavs, like the way they talk. I mean, it's just like a bunch of nonsense.
Doesn't Clockwork Orange take place in England? Like,
yes, that is exactly.
Yeah,
it.
It's
are,
like
they are all chavs.
I wimbledy dimbledy the queen at the, you know, the clock tower to the wimble dimbles and the dingle down to the bath to the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it sounds Zubi exactly galosh. Like London. Yeah,
Malenki, not Malarkey, Malenki.
No, no,
yeah, close.
Yeah.
Bazimni, though, is my new favorite one.
But the funny funny thing about it is, though, is that as you read the funny thing about this Malenki is that as you read this Googlazook book, you start to pick up on the words and you start to realize that he actually did build a vocabulary. So they do actually mean things.
No, I don't have a problem with people like building their own languages. I don't want to hear them. That's my issue, is I don't care about how much work you put into your fake language. I'm not interested. If I was somebody who like got interested in that and did all the lore fag stuff, all right, fine. You know, sure, maybe there's a type of people that kind of entertainment is good for. It's just not me. I'm not interested. My thing.
I think it's better when you start out slow and build up to it. Right.
Yeah.
So like if you start out at the gate with like all of the Grudies and the I'm just taking words from random now, Devakshas and everything, like the audience just kind of turns off, right? You really need to start reading it. But if you start out with like one or two words and then explain it to the audience and then one or more two words, by the end of the book, you could be reading something like this and completely understand everything that it says.
Yeah. I think the other really good way to do made-up words is if you're operating within the confines of a pre-existing language, for example, English. I think this is something that Battletech did really well with the clans, is that they had this thing where they have all these made-up words, but the words are all like sort of portmanteaus or sort of shortenings or smudges together pre-existing words. So like once you...
That's kind of like Shakespeare.
Kinda, yeah. So like when you see something like Bachal and then you're like, well, what the fuck is that? And then they're like, oh, it's a shortening of battle challenge and this is what it means. It's like, oh, that's very intuitive. And every time you see that, it makes sense, right? Because it's based off of pre-existing words. It's not completely without precedent.
Yeah, and that is exactly what Shakespeare did when he invented all those new words all that time ago. I mean, he came up with, you know, bedroom. It's the room with the bed in it. Okay, yeah, no, that's intuitive. Now we just think as bedroom is one word.
To be fair, when Shakespeare was alive, English's sort of Germanic influence is a lot more readily apparent in the language. So, like, just sort of jamming words together was a lot more common back in the day. So not really considered, like, common now, but Shakespeare wasn't exactly as much inventing words as much as he was just sort of engaging in the time-honored tradition of Germanic languages of just, like, combining nouns together to make a more specific noun, you know?
Yeah.
Which we don't do anymore.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with that. My biggest problem with Dune is that it's appealing to Arabic words in an attempt to create this alternate setting. And I get that that's part of the... I guess I just don't have any respect for Arabs. I don't want Arabic sci-fi.
Well, the entire use of the Arabic words in Dune, I think, is to evoke a feeling of mysticism and sort of foreignness and alienness to the reader, who most likely is an right. Anglophone, which, like, there are only, like, a few languages so that you can really use for that. If you want to go for, like, medieval mysticism, you can kind of lean into, like, Gaelic or Celtic languages. But if you want to create this weird sort of religious, hazy, Far Eastern, deserty kind of feel, you go with something that sounds Arabic or Farsi or something like that.
Right, and I'm saying I don't really want a story that's set there.
Well, understanding what I do about the plot and the author's goal for theming, I think he actually made the correct choice. Morgoth of Morgoth's Review did a very, very good video about Dune, and he actually goes over why, like, when he was like a basic, like, conservative, he really didn't like it on the first thing because he was all in that anti-Islam thing, so he completely disregarded it. And then when he picked it up later, he was able to sort of set aside the trappings and understand what the author was getting at with the themes and interface with the deeper sort of story that's there on a more, I guess, intellectual and appreciative level.
Yeah, I'm not doing the anti-Islam. I'm just racist against Arabs.
That's okay.
Those are different things.
You know what book series really did it very well was Harry Potter.
Oh yeah, that is a good point. Harry Potter does a very good job of explaining all of its made up crap to the reader.
Did it have a lot of made up words? I don't remember that.
Very few.
Muggle.
It had very few, but it introduced them and it would explain them very slowly in a way that you could sort of like latch onto them.
And I think what really helped it though was the fact that it took place in a modern it took place in a modern setting and then went into a much different realm, but then always kept
urban fantasy.
Yeah, and then always kept returning back to that setting so that you kind of like always kept yourself grounded. So these words, when the made up words, when they kept talking about these things, they just kind of like seeped into you, you know, and you were able to like instantly know what they were.
What was her word that she used to come up with people who felt like they were women, but they were actually men?
I don't know. I think that's in the unpublished version, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Hormones.
Gotcha. Okay.
I actually thought of that pun. You laid me up.
Yeah. I'm guessing she had some word like, I don't know, mud gendered. I don't know.
Yeah, mud gendered.
They're transmuggles.
Gender muggles.
They're muggles who want to magically transform themselves into the opposite gender.
So I actually heard that she wrote a crime novel about a transgendered like psychopath who just murders women.
Are you serious?
Yeah, which actually, I'm kind of low-key interested. I really kind of want to read it because it sounds like a very interesting premise. And everything I've heard about it is like, well, this is actually a fairly competently written crime novel. And, you know, it goes into some of the psychology, so I'm kind of curious, but at the same time, I'm like, is it going to be cringe? I don't know. It sounds interesting.
Yeah. Troubled Blood. It was just released. It was just released in September 2020.
Yeah, yeah.
Just last month.
Yeah.
You guys want to go up to the bookstore and wait in line for it?
Oh my god, that's another thing we have to talk about. We went to a Barnes & Noble.
Oh yeah, we did.
Guys, we went to a Barnes. I forgot. I was listening back to our last episode and we were talking about, I don't know, guys, have you ever been to a Barnes & Noble? And I was like, not in 5 years. Well, Mongoose and I went to a Barnes & Noble.
Man, I love Barnes & Nobles. It's like this pure concentrated, like, it's like a castle of cringe. You just go in there and you can see all these cringy crap and tchotchkes.
My god,
everywhere.
It was so bad. It was there. They had shrines set up to various shit lib celebrities, including, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They had the whole shrine set up to her and Obama and Hillary Clinton still for some reason.
Yeah,
that was weird.
The sort of favorites at like both Books a Million and Barnes and Noble are Dianne Feinstein, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Michelle Obama, and Hillary Clinton are like that's like the quadrinity of yes, queen, slay, kind of deal, you know?
You can cut that out, right, John?
Yeah, I'm going to cut all that. Spoiler alert, I'm not cutting that out.
Spoiler alert, he didn't cut it out.
Yeah.
Yes. You didn't notice, but the blood coming out of your eardrums did.
Yeah. No, but I wanted to talk about the female equivalent of Monster Girls and why it is disgusting and degenerate.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we should talk about this. I mean, Monster Girlist ideology has a lot of threats from all directions nowadays, and we keep,
right.
This can be an ongoing thought process. But yes, John, would you like to deliver your book report,
yes,
based on the back summaries of these books you found?
Right, because I didn't actually read these books, but yeah, so we went around and looked at all the different sections of books, and one of them that we came up to was like romance novels. I don't remember what the actual name
of it
was.
Yeah, it literally is called just the romance section, which
romance
is,
okay.
It's literally like the female equivalent of pornography, for those who,
okay,
are not in the know.
Right. So we found out that there is an entire genre, and they've mentioned this on another podcast. I first heard about it on the Young Whites, and they had a great report on this. There is an entire genre about women who write quote-unquote romance novels about getting fucked by animals.
Well, they get fucked by guys who are like...
who transform into animals.
Into animals and then back into guys.
Yes.
So it's like a hot dude, but he's also a leopard, but he's also a hot dude. See, like... This is
there's
like
a lot of these.
Yeah.
There's like different versions too. There's then a lot of these are from the same author, Christine Feehan.
Yeah.
And she's written several series, like Ghost Walker series, the Leopard series is the big one with all these animal things. But like Shadow series, Torpedo Inc. series.
Torpedo Inc. It sounds like oh, yeah, yeah, I work at Torpedo Inc. at the Wolfpack. We hunt down the British shipping. Yeah, yeah.
No, Torpedo Inc. is about a outlaw motorcycle club in a dangerously sexy new series from number one New York Times bestselling author Christine Feehan. Oh, God. All right.
I feel like dying.
The problem is the Leopard series, though. The Leopard series is about a series of novels about different men who turn into leopards or panthers. Some of them are like, she's kind of cheating. I know she called it leopard, but some of them do panthers. But
those
yeah,
are like the two most cringe big cats. Like, could you go with like cougars and lions?
Yeah.
Like, come on, bad taste, bad form.
I think cougars might have a different meaning, but
yeah, yeah, she's not writing about that kind of cougar.
Like the big muscly like black arm and the white arm from The Predator where they're like grabbing each other.
Yeah.
We need like a Christine Feehan, Nicholas J. Fuentes, and at the center they're like, it's like cat boys.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I want to talk about that really fast because like,
well, let me I want to read out one of the things.
Okay,
on this.
And then I have something I want to say. So go ahead.
Okay. This is from the back of Leopard's Blood, which has a woman's face right next to a snarling leopard, or I don't know if it's a leopard, a cougar, or whatever that is, face right next to it. And it says, every beat of her heart arouses the senses of a man who stalks the shadows. Though born into a leopard's lair in the bayou, Joshua Tregre's fighting skills were honed in the rainforests of Borneo. Sleek and deadly, he's the perfect man to take over a crime syndicate back home in Louisiana's lush swamplands. His razor-sharp instincts give him an edge in the violent underworld he knows so well, but even the watchful leopard inside him isn't prepared for the threat that comes from the girl next door. And Christine's notes on this are... this is the first book where I start out with the woman already in an actual heat. She has a relationship with her female, and she set up a large area where her female can run free, but there's a shifter nearby, and she ends up having to do the walk of shame 7 times.
I feel like there's deep lore here that we are thankfully not privy to.
There's no deep lore. This is just women fanfic.
Well, yeah, but like this is like the woman equivalent of like the Monster Girl Encyclopedia, where it has its own like internal quote unquote rules, I guess. Which actually I kind of want to like talk about here, because like the entire idea of like a Monster Girl as form is like if you had like a Leopard Girl, It's like
they're not leopard girls. Okay,
well,
that's,
no.
This is where we need to start.
I'm talking theoretically. If you have the form of a leopard girl, right? It's not that she is a leopard. She has the traits of the leopard. She represents a Hegelian synthesis of a Platonic ideal, right? It's not this entire weird, like, I want it both ways because I'm actually into bestiality type deal that, like, Miss Feehan engages in, I guess. It's very bizarre.
Oh, by the way, do you guys know what Miss Feehan looks like?
My guess is some kind of weird-looking, ugly crone.
This is I know this is an age-old Little Wars thing, but take a look in the recording booth, gentlemen.
Oh, yeah, she looks exactly like I imagined. An ugly, fat, old crone.
It's like imagine a wine aunt, and then someone put about 200 pounds of lard into
her. Yeah, she looks like that crazy woman from Tiger King. She might be related to her.
Oh, yeah?
Crazy lady from Tiger King who has all those tigers and stuff.
Yeah, all right. I've never seen this gay show.
Dude, it's the same energy. She has those, like, crazy cat lady eyes. It's the same vibe. Dude, it's literally the same energy. Same energy, bro. Okay. This is, like...
Well, she's definitely a crazy cat lady because she wants to fuck cats.
This is unbelievable levels of cursed.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, so the thing is, these women... Their idea of this, like, erotic thing is men who can turn into these animals and fuck them. And it's, like, it's this weird thing where it's not I won't say it's entirely physical, because there's, like, this whole portrayal of them as, like, these dangerous, mysterious dudes.
Beasts.
Like really laying into the dangerousness or shifty,
very,
secretiveness.
Bad boy.
Right,
yes,
the bad boy thing.
Yes. Going back to Manosphere 101.
Ironically. But I won't say it's entirely physical, but this is definitely a level of, I don't know, shallowness, I guess, that is just remarkable seeing coming. I mean, it's not remarkable because these are women that we're dealing with here, but it's just interesting seeing it laid out in such obvious and unsecretive and unsubtle methods that this is all that it is for a woman. It's about having those baseline elements of bad boy, secretive and dangerous and capable of violence, combined with white women fuck dogs, or in this case, cats.
Well, and big cats too.
So you've taken the dog pill off of the incel wiki. The cat pill.
We talked about this. Yeah, the cat pill. The big cat pill. It's such a weird pill to take because nobody has a pet big cat. Like, that wasn't part of the equation.
A wise man once said we should stop using the word pills and start using the word suppositories. And in this case, I can't help but agree.
No, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, I know. Honestly, the entire, like, I'm X-pilled is like...
You're the one who brought it up,
I know,
you retard.
Because I'm referencing something, but that terminology is gay.
I don't care. I do not care.
This entire
My
discussion
is
creepy, honestly.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's creepy that they have an entire shelf of this stuff, an entire rack of these types of books in a Barnes & Noble.
That's not the kind of rack I want to see.
Oh, my God. All right.
I mean, speaking of racks, you know, they removed Monster Musume from the manga section. Like, they don't sell it anymore.
They did.
So, like, they're selling this stuff, but they won't sell you Monster Girl fiction. This is an ideological attack.
Truly, Monster Girl fans are the most oppressed race.
Yes. This, but unironically. Every day I'm denied a Monster Girl waifu is a day my human rights are systematically being, like, oppressed and denied by the United States government.
Hmm. Jack, you know what they did have over in the manga section, though?
Uh-oh. What's that?
Ruby, spelled R-W-B-Y.
Isn't that a Rooster Teeth production?
Yes.
You know, we should do a deep dive on that at some point. Not a deep dive, but we should, like, talk about it. Because there's some stuff to unpack there in terms of, like, really bad world building and what not to do. Also, really bad character. There's a lot of bad that
we've got a buddy that does an entire podcast on it. I'm not interested in rehashing that.
We have an expert, then.
I don't want it. All right, whatever. if you can, guys can talk him into coming on here, if we can relate that to world building somehow or storytelling. I don't
know. Well, it's all storytelling. Like, yeah, there's a lot of just bad storytelling. Well, there is bad storytelling everywhere, and you have to point it all out.
All right, fine. Well, speaking of good storytelling, we've been having fun doing Mongoose's role-playing game.
Yeah, yep. We forgot to do, like, what are you doing this week? Because we kind of got sidetracked by this crazy cat lady.
Well, this is what we did this week. We saw Christine Feehan books in real life for this week.
Yeah, this month. Yeah, what did I do this month? I ran my game a bunch. I got some plastic models that are nice, you know. And we saw Christine Feehan in the Barnes & Noble IRL. It was so traumatizing. We have to traumatize the audience as well.
Wait a second. That lady who rolled up to like make sure that we weren't there to steal anything, she was really, really fat and in a wheelchair. That might have been Christine Feehan.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah, we were constantly being harassed by Barnes & Noble employees asking very aggressively if we needed any help.
Well, we're good. This is what happens when Denver and I go to Barnes & Noble's, because that's like one of our hobbies, is we just, once in a while we go to a bookstore just to see what kind of dumb crap there is. And we'll just walk around, we'll just like pull a book off the shelf and just like turn on like the A-tone voice, just be like, hey, what the fuck is this shit? Like, one of my favorites is going into bookstores, finding the Holocaust books, and then very loudly asking Denver what the Holocaust is, and then acting the idea of it is absurd. Like, you're telling me there was like, 6 million of them? That's a big high number. It sounds crazy. And they just kind of started killing them just arbitrarily or something?
Yeah, we thought about moving some of the Christine Feehan books over to the Holocaust section. the Leopard Holocaust.
Never forget the Shifter Holocaust. 69 million.
69 million shifters were rounded up and killed so women can't have access to mysterious, dangerous bad boys.
69 million shifters were poached for their fur. Never forget.
That's why they wore the Hugo Boss, because it was a fashion war. They were fighting the fur accessories and fur coat wearers.
Well, I mean, you get the fur accessories and fur coat wearers as war trophies from fighting the shifters.
Okay. All right. Yeah. See, if they had won, if the Nazis had won, Hugo Boss would have had a whole new line.
Yeah,
you'd
have seen like Hitler in this big like pimp leather, like not pimp. You'd be like in this pimp leopard, like leopard spot, like robe thing, you know?
Oh my god.
He rolls out of the freaking Mercedes. You know.
All right. I have to ask.
Opening shot of Triumph of the Will, except it's Hitler in the leopard pimp coat walking out of the airplane. That would slap.
All right, but are any of these leopard shifters Jews? Does that ever come up?
Dude, I don't know.
Christine Feehan?
I don't.
Does she have proper representation, I wonder? Is that a thing? I don't know. Is that possible? They're always like,
this is one of those things where it's like, you ask the question, I don't want the answer.
Oh, come on. I think it'd be interesting.
No.
Oh my god. I just checked one of the other books and Christine's notes says, this is the first book, and this is book nine in the series. This is the first book in which I show the woman can hear and communicate with her leopard.
Her leopard.
This book nine is the first book where the woman can communicate with the leopard she's fucking.
Christine Feehan is like Carol Baskin's relative or something. But this has to be true. I
don't know who is that.
That's the crazy lady from Tiger King.
Oh, all right. I don't watch Tiger King.
Like, you should have seen it. It's on the same level of like disgusting awfulness. Like, literally,
you got Tiger King, you got your Leopard Queen, you know.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. So anyway, Jack, I'm sorry you couldn't come to Barnes & Noble with us for this.
I'm so sorry you had to miss out on Christine Feehan, bro. Man, it was really good.
Okay, John.
I actually go to Barnes & Noble every once in a while just to do exactly that, just to look around at what the most recent cult of narcissism has for me.
Have you looked at like the role playing game section and all the it's all D&D
Yes,
just so much D&D.
I took a picture. We went to a
You can get the Ruby board game at Barnes & Noble.
Yes, thank you.
I think it's called a V-Stock. I think it's a V-Stock. I don't know if you have those there, but
no.
But yeah, they have a role playing game section, and I showed you pictures of that.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, Barnes & Noble is just terrible, man. Oh, I did not realize it was that bad. Like I said, I hadn't been in there in like 5 years, and I went in and I was just like, wow. All right.
Yeah.
But anyway, all right, let's move past that. So we played a couple of sessions of Mongoose's role-playing game, and that's been going very well. It's been very interesting. Mongoose created his own system for running and managing. Yeah, running and managing a settlement, a city. We're colonialism now. We imperialism gang. We've created a settlement on this new planet, and that's been going very fun. Last night's session that we had actually was extremely fun. We had a lot of good roleplay between characters, a lot of good conversation going. I thought it was a lot smoother than it had been, and one of the reasons for that was I basically a lot of times use my character as like the prompt to engage other players and get their characters talking and seeing what their characters think. Like talking about the future, talking about what their thoughts are, what their plans are with all a bunch of different characters. I don't know if you guys noticed that last night.
I was aware. John, I know what you were doing. Congratulations, you did good. Here's your little pat on the head.
I'm not looking for a pat on the head.
I just thought you were talking to people. I didn't know there was a strategy there.
Yeah, I am talking to people, but I'm talking to people to get people talking because that's one thing I noticed. Like for instance, two sessions ago, is that without prompting, a lot of players don't seem to really engage in role playing. Like a lot of people are just like, all right, I go here. All right, I put down the thing. All right, I go look for this thing. All right, I find it. I read what's on it. All right, it's like they don't. A lot of times, it seems like there's a lot of hesitation towards getting into character and interacting in the world around them in character without that prompting and like you know almost like giving them a little writing prompt of, you know, well. Here's what we're doing, and here's what the future looks like. What are your thoughts about what this future looks like and where you want to be in that future? Like, I mean, my character asked yours that, Jack.
Yeah.
And that got you thinking about it. I talked to Sue about that, for a Proof's character, Sue, about that. Talked to Elias about what his thoughts are with Ronya and, like, where things are going with that. Like, I did that multiple times throughout the thing to get people moving, and everybody responds to that with roleplay, but... it's like not until kind of prompted. And I'm wondering what your guys' thoughts are on that and how to kind of foster that in a more natural way than just having one player be the ringleader and like prompting other players to get into roleplay.
I try to do it with NPCs a lot of the times. It doesn't always work.
Well, what are your thoughts on when it does work and when it doesn't? What seems to work better?
What seems to work better is it depends on a player-to-player basis. For one thing, when the game master kind of starts coming in with those things, it can feel like almost a little authoritative. So some types of players will be less willing to sort of engage with NPCs, whereas they'll be more willing if it's a, another character. But most player characters are not proactive enough to try to engage with one another. That's something I just sort of... a lot of players tend to be very passive. They kind of want, to have their hands held. That's one of the big lies about role-playing games is that the greatest evil is railroading. Everybody wants to be railroaded, but they want to be railroaded through a very wonderful roller coaster. People only notice when they're being railroaded when it's a very boring, plain, straight, narrow track.
Okay, well you're veering off a little bit because I want to keep this in the terms of. How can we encourage players to be more active instead of just, you know, working around the fact that players tend to not be very active? They tend to be, you're right, like I've noticed that, and especially in your player group, I'm not really used to this, and so it's been a little bit weird for me. I'm very much used to more active players who want to go out there and explore and talk to people and do their own plots. What do you guys think about how it could be, you know, from either side, from the player side, on like another player side, or from the game master's perspective? How can you encourage people to be more proactive and engaged with the setting and the surroundings than, you know, they tend to be? And I'm thinking about this because I've been working on my game and preparing for that, and I would like to have more engaged and proactive players and not ones that just sit back and wait for, you know, developments or plot or whatever to be spoon-fed to them?
It's a little difficult. You actually have to know the sort of player outside their character, which actually has a lot more influence on things than a lot of us would like to pretend. So as a game master, you have to metagame in that way and oftentimes play to their psychology rather
than...
You're
talking about what motivates them, right?
Yeah, what do you think they'll like or think is cool or think meshes with their character rather than what objectively might work?
Okay, what do you think, Jack? What are your strategies for getting people kind of acting more actively in the setting?
I think it has to do with conflict. Like Mongoose said, you know, a little bit of railroading is probably
oh yeah.
Needed.
There's always going to be real. The lie of the sandbox is one of the most like absurd lies that people like to tell. It's like, oh, you can just show up and do whatever. Well, then people do nothing because there's no momentum. So you got to give them momentum.
Well, it's the same thing with like open world video games, almost like the idea that every game nowadays has to be open world. And now you're just left with a ton of very empty open world games with almost nothing to do in them. And at some point, a more
like Minecraft.
Yeah, well, Minecraft's the emergent gameplay is supposed to be from the multiplayer.
Look how he recoils.
Well, it's semi-true. Solo Minecraft sucks ass. Minecraft is an emergent experience through like social stuff. The game is a medium for social interaction.
Aren't role-playing games supposed to be that? Why aren't role-playing games able to do emergent gameplay or emergent complexity?
The emergent social interaction of Minecraft more often than not just kind of boils down to whatever shit posting is sort of forced into the game world. There is not the restriction in Minecraft of having a character. People in Minecraft aren't LARPing like they're middle-aged tier survivors.
Yeah, but they do have Minecraft role-playing servers that I've heard are pretty popular. Joe, our friend Joe Nadislav was in one.
Yeah, those are semi-popular, but they're not as prevalent as the primary way to play the game is just through emergent interaction. Or another way that social sort of thing takes place is mini-games will be built within the game itself for people to play against each other. So the game itself, Minecraft, the game is actually almost a metagame that holds a bunch of other sub-games. So I guess it's not directly analogous, almost.
Well, it could be if you had the mechanics in your sandbox role-playing game that acted like that almost. But
yeah,
I think you're right, because when I think back to the best open world game sandbox games that I've played, video games that I've played, they've all had a world that's full of like interesting set pieces and characters and locations and whatnot and various challenges to go through, but they also have an overriding goal and an objective, and oftentimes they'll break it down into like specific miniature or you know sub objectives underneath that. So like in Shadow of Mordor, your goal is to eventually kill the Sauron's right hand man, is that the tower I think is his name, and along that way, okay, you know, you need to kill his three lieutenants or whatever. Well, along the way, in order to do that, you have to get strong enough to beat this guy, and then you can go fight, you know, he'll reveal the location of the first lieutenant, you go, and then you got to go from there, and you got to build up an army to besiege the castle to get the second lieutenant. So you know, like, it builds up through that. Even though it is a sandbox, you can go wherever. There's kind of a big arrow in the background. It's a lot more subtle than a racing game where if you're going the wrong way, it has an arrow saying wrong way, wrong way. But there's still that kind of like semi-transparent arrow in the sky saying like, yeah, you can go this way, but the thing you need is for the goal that you're after is over in this direction. You know, so it's almost like a gentle nudging to get people on back onto the sort of railroad, even though they can go do a bunch of side stuff that might even help them out with the eventual thing that they're trying to do.
Yeah, obviously you need an overarching goal in anything, because without it, you don't have a story. You just have a series of disconnected and disjointed. You have a pastiche of experiences rather than an actual sort of overarching narrative. So you're left with a postmodern, quote unquote, story, but that's not something that people particularly enjoy. And postmodern sort of literature and story, storytelling, it's not really a story or a narrative. You just kind of have to use that word for convention's sake. Really is more about pointing out things about your lived experiences rather than it is trying to craft a narrative that you understand or experience in any way. So again, that's not directly comparable. So the idea that you have to have an overarching story is kind of a must, or some kind of goal in theory. Like, yeah, that's kind of a must. And a series of goals. Yeah, you have to do that to set up a narrative arc. Yes. These things are all kind of, they kind of logically follow.
No, I know that, but do you think that you've done that with your current role-playing group, or were you kind of reliant upon the players to organically create goals for themselves and for their characters and then strive towards those?
See, the issue is when I think of building a city, there are a series of things that need to happen in that seem relatively obvious, I guess, to me, but apparently not to people. That I just sort of assumed everyone's going to kind of realize there's a certain like group of things that need to be accomplished here, and those have a bunch of prerequisites, and they're going to naturally drift towards those things that they want to do that need to be accomplished. The problem is that most people are not, I guess, civically minded enough to think like, well, if I want to build a city, what do I have to do in order to do that? I guess that's just something most people don't know about or think about. So,
well, that's what I'm interested in then.
Yeah, I made the mistake of thinking my players know more than they already did. Yeah, and that's why I introduced the mechanical system.
Yeah, there's that. That is a really good that's a good point, is that the mechanics provided that bridging gap between the overarching narrative and goal structure and the ways that the players can move towards them, you know, in a much more palpable and manageable manner. But one thing that I'm interested in then is how you could get your players to internalize those overarching goals into the player characters' minds in terms of something that they're actually striving towards, and not just like having it so that like, oh, well, I guess this is what we're doing Tuesday. Well, I don't know what we're doing Wednesday. I'm not thinking about it yet because we're still here on Tuesday right now. So like how could you encourage them to think about these things, or can you?
You really can't at some point. Like at some point as the game master, you have a lot of things to manage, and trying to psychologically manage your player characters and their players is beyond you.
Okay.
I mean, this is the sort of thing where you're demanding a level of sort of omnipotence on the part of the GM that is simply not manageable, given their other constraints and things they have to do. So you can try to incentivize things. You can try to bait them. You can have your NPCs sort of try to nudge them along. But and it's also, you have to think about, like, you can't fall for the sunk cost fallacy. You can't just keep going and going and going. You just kind of have to on the fly figure out what works and kind of do that. And, you know, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't.
What do you think, Jack?
That's actually a good question. I mean, I agree mostly with what Mongoose said right there. I think that to railroad your players too hard is probably not something that you should do. What I usually do, my personal experience, I don't know if this is good or bad, this is just my personal experience, is that I usually implement a lot of different obstacles for them, right? And those obstacles give subtle hints as to where they need to go, right? So, and as far as role playing with each other goes, I usually do, a small amount of danger for each person based on like how they interact with the world at large, right? So what I really like about Mongoose's game is that he made us do a bunch of hindrances, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I don't usually do that, but what I will do is I'll take the quirks of their characters. Like if somebody is a druid walking around in a city, let's say, right, like in a urban setting, he's gonna feel depressed. He's gonna feel he's going to feel a little jittery and everything like that. And his clothing is going to look alien and all this other stuff. So he's going to have a little bit of difficulty talking to people. So he's going to have to ask others to talk to people for them and that kind of thing, right? So so I kind of push my players together in a way like that, right? Also kind of like how Mongoose implemented languages in his in his thing. So basically some of us can't talk to others, you know, and you know, sometimes all of us can't talk, which is why I'm thankful that I brought the the speak languages power.
Yeah.
That was pretty useful. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But let me ask you about this then. How would you go from your character, who's not really thinking about the future, as was kind of evidenced through the role play yesterday, what would be the way then to kind of encourage you as the player, or to kind of guide you into a position where your character started having these more long-term thoughts? Is there a way that, for instance, Mongoose or another player could do that besides just being like, or is just like, you know, natural conversation the best way? Hey, dude, have you thought about what Jolnar is thinking about the future? You know, like what would you say? Yeah, using you as a case study.
The answer in an out of character context is yes, I have. I just haven't told you.
Okay. And, well, just if you hadn't though, what would be your advice?
Well, okay. So what my advice is that I would suggest they encourage their players to come up with backstories, because if somebody has a backstory, they have a future. They're not just constantly in the moment, right? Like so my example before, a druid in the city, like that druid has a backstory. Why is he in a city right now? And he feels very uncomfortable. And what are his plans? Is he going to perhaps maybe his plan for the future could be to create a park in the middle of the city, right? Or something like that. But I also think that your future plan should not be just like in real life. Your future plan should not be like completely set in stone, right? You should have goals, but your future plan should not be, you know, this is exactly how I want my character to end up. Please fulfill this wish fulfillment for me, Mr. GM. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to go that far, obviously, of planning things out. But yeah, just getting people to encourage them to even think about these things in the first place. Because, yeah, I think you're right. Having that having that past to be rooted in helps you to have an idea for the future as well.
Yeah.
So maybe that's something that we could work on more in future games is like, hey, write me up a paragraph of what your character's been through, or the past that they've been through.
Well, you know? Well, and I think the subject of goals doesn't come up enough to like one of our characters, Sue, is had a goal to find her sister. I think right, so once you know he got done with that goal, like there was really not much for him to do, right? So I do think that railroading like almost MMO-ish like quests, right, in a linear fashion is helpful. But it should be like kind of in the background, you know.
Interesting. What do you mean by quests and linear quests?
Well, just like, you know,
like mission state or mission structure.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, okay. Like go retrieve this box from tomb, right? And then of course it's the GM's obligation to you know make it not just about retrieving a box from a tomb. Right. If you think about the Indiana Jones movies, except I guess for the last one, although the last one probably has this in common as well. If you think about the Indiana Jones movies, the it's always about retrieving something from an old place. Right. But along the way, the whole point of the adventure is the adventure. Right. It's less about finding the golden idol and more about, you know, doing all of the crazy escapades, right?
Right, right. All right, yeah, I think that's a pretty good point. What do you think, Mongoose?
I think that's all right advice. I think some of it does come down to it. I don't know, getting players motivated for things, even when players have well written out character backstories, it can be difficult for them to sort of connect that to their character, I've found. So that isn't always the best solution. I've found that's almost as hit or miss as anything else. So there's not really like a good way to to sort of like do that. It just sort of, I think the solution to this problem ultimately is, I guess, classist in a sense, in that like you just have to select your players reasonably well.
Yes, okay, so, I agree. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think it's okay to have a mix of people who aren't necessarily going to be pursuing their characters' motivations, because if you have everybody has complex goals and everybody is running off all over the place to try and follow them, you're just going to wind up with a mess where nobody's working together.
Well, yeah, obviously this is elastic, right? You know, yeah. you should put as much as you think your players can handle and not anymore.
Or be able to juggle between like different people's goals. Like there was a while there where we were going around looking for Sue's sister, or we were going around, you know, looking, doing missions to make money, and then also going around looking for a place to set up the settlement. So yeah, there's a lot of different goals that can be juggled. And I think possibly by, you know, and this might be something to consider, Mongoose, maybe by introducing a, like one of those goals or an element of that that has to be juggled as well, it can kind of keep people engaged, because I think people tend to like doing problem solving maybe a little more than, you know, finding your own fun, basically, you know, setting your own goals and pursuing those. So I think, and I've noticed that in the past, is that when there's, you know, a problem to be solved, our players got much more engaged. You know, when we were under attack on a river, people kind of wake up and like, oh, my character does something all of a sudden, even though I haven't spoken for an hour and a half.
I think that they think that has more to do with combat and the potential for combat than it does anything else.
Well, that's an interesting topic right there. Is that something we should talk about? Is combat just a crutch? Which I think we all think it's a crutch, probably, because it kind of is.
It is.
But is that a bad thing? And is there any way to make it better?
It is. It's a bad thing, and there's no way to improve it. The unfortunate thing is a lot of people go into role-playing games with a combat mindset. Like, they're trained on video games and all interactive storytelling to people essentially has combat in a very, very primary role. And even role-playing games themselves tend to have combat as a large portion of their internal rule set, so people tend to expect it. Basically,
that's depressing.
Well, yeah, basically, until you completely strip down the until you give somebody a system where combat is almost completely stripped out of it, and it doesn't, they don't have that mechanical ability to sort of make number get big and get better odds, you're always going to be wrangling with this. It's a perennial issue.
That game would have to be fundamentally not about combat. If you're going to have mechanics at all, you'd have to have like very different rules and like things that people can be good at and ways that they can interact in the world without them besides combat.
Right, because you have to think about like how do games, most systems treat fighting versus, a sort of like conversation that's sort of adversarial. Because ultimately, the difference is like how do you treat war versus politics? Like how do you systematize these two things, right? So, like, you know, war is a fight and politics is an adversarial conversation. If you don't have, like, mechanics other than, like, maybe two different types of skill roles for an adversarial conversation, and you have entire chapters devoted to how to have a fight, it's always going to be about having a fight. And people are going to expect, because people will build their characters to the express purpose of being good at having a fight. Even when that's kind of, like, not the expectation and they should know better. By the sort of tone of the game and the established expectations, people will still fall for that mistake because they're kind of wired that way. And also like that the JRPG like gotcha mindset of just getting bigger numbers, better numbers, like it translates over into role-playing games because they have numbers and they have mechanics. Like it's still a thing. People care about these things. It's just the way they're wired. So yeah, combat's a crutch. There's very little you can do about it with pre-existing systems. And that's a bad thing.
Can you then, like, is your advice then to build a system that focuses on whatever the core that your game is going to be and to kind of leave combat at or make it a very small part of that? And there are a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse games that are doing this where the player move, you know, the stats aren't specifically combat related. A lot of them are like, for instance, the original Apocalypse World had hot firm, hard, sharp, or whatever. And they were like a combination of social and physical and mental attributes. Like sharp is both your, you know, the sharpness of your tongue as well as your like capacity for quick violence and reflexes. And so then like
that's a mediocre kind of stopgap solution where you just cut everything down to where it's all indistinguishable, right?
Yeah.
It would almost more interesting to see a system that expands upon social interactions to the same degree that like a Dungeons and Dragons or Savage Worlds or Dark Heresy expands upon sort of combat interactions where you have resources like influence or this, that, or the other, where conversation, there are rules for how conversations go and different types of verbal attacks. And players would actually have to rely on these sorts of things along with their role play. The problem is...
Oh my gosh, that just reminded me, Exalted does that. Like, Exalted 2 has an entire system about, like, conversational... They call it social combat, but it's actually, like, making points and defending your points and, like, getting influence.
Right,
And they've got motivations. Like, NPCs or crowds have motivations, and you can discover them through social interactions and using your insight or whatever the name of it is in there. And, like, manipulate people by appealing to those specific motivations and creating new motivations through different things. But the problem is, and what you were saying made me think of, that system is so goddamn clunky that nobody uses it when they play Exalted. It would turn every, like, conversation or debate into, like, a four-hour rule slog, basically.
Yeah, well, people play D&D, and combat in that game is a fucking 4 hours rule slog. Like, there's really no excuse.
I don't like that either, though. Well, I don't like D&D
I know,
either, though.
But, like, well, how do you take that really clunky system that's only been tried once and cut it down to the point where it's as enjoyable as, like, you need to do to Exalted Combat what Savage Worlds does to D20 combat. Cut it down to the point where it's understandable, enjoyable, fast, and loose.
Yeah, I'd imagine, I don't know, yeah. I think one of the biggest problems this runs into is that, like, the best part about conversations, or I don't know if it's even the best, but it's, like, the institutionally most respected part of doing conversations in a role-playing game is that it's all about what the players say and the things that they can come up with and the ways that they go about exploring things in a social circumstance. And if you try to mechanize that too much, you're going to be moving into a realm where, like, I roll to intimidate. I roll to determine motivation.
People already do that, though. I mean...
Well, you don't let people do that.
I don't, because I'm... But you can write a... You can, like, the way Ryutama forces players to, in combat, narrate their actions in order to acquire bonuses. You can do the same thing in your RPG. You could almost have the game master have a lot of leeway over what is going to succeed and fail based on their impression of the character's roleplay.
Right. So have the roleplay be like a permission to engage the mechanic.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. What do you think, Jack?
I pretty much agree with Mongoose. I mean, I don't know. I guess I don't see combat as much of a detriment, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because we had a lot of combat in your Star Wars game, and I thought it was pretty fun, too, and we had a lot of story connecting it as well.
If you have a combat-focused game, it's all right.
But. Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, I'm much more of a war gamer, right? And I tend to weave combat and violence a little bit more into my stories, because honestly, I think that if you are on the edge of you know, because in our Star Wars game we were on the edge of civilization, right? So there was going to be a lot of violence, but the violence was probably also going to be structured in such a way that it would in a much more honorable way than in a civilized setting, if you know what I mean by that, right? Like, so
honorable,
yeah, or a more virtuous than in a civilized setting. So in a civilized setting, you have a lot of violence directed at people to keep them in line because you have too many people, right? In a more I guess, on the edges of civilization or beyond it, you have much more of a, like, clannish, honor type thing. So if you impinge my honor, I can do violence against you. In a civilized setting, that won't be possible, right? However, right. In a civilized setting, you could be staring down the barrel of several elite guard who have come to kill you, right? Because you are breaking the law, right? Mm. But in a more uncivilized portion of the galaxy, as long as you give somebody the respect that they are due, they're probably not going to be violent against you, unless of course they have like a bounty on you or something, right?
Yeah.
So as long as you show them respect, you know, you're at least going to have a way to resolve things peacefully.
Gotcha. Okay. So you like weaving violence into the social interactions as like an option of that's like a type of social interaction almost, or like a consequence of it.
Yes. And obviously it depends on where you're doing it and what the context is, right?
Right.
And I think that makes things a little bit more interesting, right?
What would you say to Mongoose about the mindset of like violence in RPGs bad? Like how, you know, because I don't know if he's, well, because Mongoose is usually the game master, so I don't think he's really done the kind of game like that, like you ran, where it's like there's a lot of combat and fighting, but there's also an ongoing story and character threads and motivations and all this kind of stuff. But fighting is one of the many ways that characters socially or, you know, interact or influence the world around them.
I'm okay with it as a storytelling mechanism. The reason I stray away from it in role-playing games is primarily mechanical, because people tend to, everything kind of hits molasses and it all kind of turns into like, what's my modifier? What do I roll again? What do I do? And it doesn't matter how much fighting there is in a game. Like,
Do I roll a wild die?
Yeah. I'm anticipating the sort of like, well, you just don't have enough fighting in your games. Therefore, like, people aren't going to get used to the rules. I've had games where I've had a lot of fighting. The problem is like, it's a perennial issue. And I, quite frankly, cannot be asked to re-explain a rule system that everyone has access to over and over and over again. It's just fucking annoying, and I'm not going to do it.
Well, I think part of that might be Savage Worlds, and I know Savage Worlds is pretty damn easy, but I don't know.
If you cannot keep Savage Worlds combat together,
I know.
Like, there is no helping you. I'm sorry. Like, a literal a lobotomized individual could play Savage Worlds. An individual, a mentally challenged person could play Savage Worlds.
I get that, but that's a different problem. The problem then must be that the players aren't motivated to learn the rules, and then how do you fix that? Do you just get better players?
Yeah, that's one of those things you just kind of have to, like, prune, or either, like, you either have to, like, make it clear, like, you're either going to learn the rules, or we're just, like, you know, or you have to prune. A lot of these things, like, if people refuse to improve, you have to separate the wheat from the chaff sometimes.
Hmm.
Well, one of the things that I do to make sure that maybe as an answer to that, I tend to play fast and loose with the combat rules, like especially if it's not a Savage World game.
Yeah.
So if you take your gun out and put it against somebody's head, right? Like, let's just say that you don't have to roll to kill them.
Yeah,
right?
I've never had anybody roll to kill when they had a clean shot like that. Yeah,
right.
Obviously.
Or something like that.
I think what Mongoose is more referring to is like there are special rules in Savage Worlds when it comes to like full auto fire, suppression fire, range penalties. This like it's not like it's a lot to remember, and especially in a more combat game. Like back when I played Shadowrun, they had all of this rules, and it was way more complicated than Savage Worlds. And we just all learn those rules because we're playing this game. And Shadowrun is you're probably going to get a shootout every single mission, and you need to be ready to do it well. And one thing that helped with that was our game master was very much like, hey guys, I'm here to help you. I'll teach you how to run, you know, do all this stuff. We'll do you through sample combats. When we get into the actual combat, if you don't remember how to do the thing you're trying to do, your character stands there flustered and we're skipping your turn and the guard is going to shoot you and you're probably going to die. And he was, so he was really good at threading that needle between I am helpful and I am merciless at the same time. And I think that's something that maybe that's a way of running it, a stylistic thing that, you know, you can communicate to your players ahead of time. Look, guys, I'll help you learn these combat rules. But when it comes to it, if you're, you know, not sure of what you're doing, you're not sure what you're rolling, you're not rolling. We're skipping you. We're going on to the next person. And I've done that before in a social situation I've talked about on the show. And I mentioned that to Jack as well, where a player character was just floundering and not sure of what to do and taking a long time to decide on things. And I said, all right, as you stand there paralyzed, unsure of what to do, everything moves on around you. And sure enough, it prompted a decision. That works. Because people don't want to do the suboptimal thing, and the most suboptimal thing is nothing at all.
Yeah.
Do you not agree with rushing your players?
I think that's a great idea. In fact, my next game, I'm going to do real-time combat. I've heard it's possible, and I'm going to get some advice from a friend of the show on how to run it. And
you've got a stopwatch now. You could do little, like, you got 10 seconds.
No. It's going to be fun, and it's going to, okay. I'm basically just going to put my players through the advanced mongoose rigmarole.
Nice. All right. Cool. I'm excited about that.
Last session, I'm actually very happy to say that the advanced mongoose rigmarole is advanced. I had a player last session say that my games are more difficult than college classes. So,
well, yeah. It makes it made
advanced,
him think more. I
advanced
think
the... Civics 301 with Mongoose Kikimora.
Cool. Well, hey, I'm excited about real-time combat. That's an even greater development of the idea that I was working on there.
Yeah, this is high-level stuff. Again, this is actually an old AD&D thing that was that got left.
Really?
Behind. Yes, actually.
I
real
didn't know
time,
that was
real
in there.
Time combat is something. It's not really like a rules thing, but it's something that's people commonly did with AD&D back in the day. So
okay, so this in the rules book or no?
I'm not sure. That's why I have to ask this friend of the show who only plays AD&D.
Yeah. That would be interesting to know.
Dungeons and Dragons. Hey, Super. Yeah. I know you're out there. Thanks for the book, by the way. I'd like to get to it before we finish the show. I just want to talk about it really fast.
All right. Yeah, I think that's pretty much all I had on terms of combat and player motivation. I think Jack is definitely hitting on something correctly, that like obstacles and dangers can be a great motivation to inspire people to kind of act under pressure, almost like how time limits would cause.
That's kind of why I dumped a bunch more population on you guys at the end of the last game and made you take a huge morale hit. I thought putting a crunch on you guys would inspire people to be a little bit more creative.
Well, actually, I messaged Clement after the game and I said, hey, can you write up an inspirational poem? I'd like to do that town founding speech thing, and I'm working on a speech that my character's going to give.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see if I can message other people and get them involved along the week in terms of like,
Clement's
you know,
a pretty busy
something.
Guy, but he might be able to handle it.
I liked his poem that his character wrote before. It was really cool.
Yeah, he's a very literate person, surprisingly.
both my character and I teared up at that.
Yeah, that was very good.
He doesn't look it or sound it, but he's an extremely literate person. Very, very talented in that regard. And a good musician as well. But anyway, speaking of a different friend of the show, Super Lutheran, actually sent me a textbook recently, The Ancient Near East, an Anthology of Texts and Pictures, edited by James B. Pritchard. And so I've been reading through that recently, specifically The Descent of Ishtar into the Netherworld, based, and the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I actually finished quite recently. And for those of you who aren't aware, the Epic of Gilgamesh is a largely incomplete, and by incomplete, I mean we don't have a complete sort of translation of it, because it's so old, many portions of it have just sort of been lost to the ruination of the things it was written on. But it's a it's a very it's a very simple story. It sort of follows, I guess, three arcs. The first arc is there's this guy named Gilgamesh, and he's the king of a city called Uruk. And basically, he's an incredibly he's very vitalistic. He's hyperborean in nature. He's an aristocrat of the soul and a body, and he drives his people too hard. He's having sex with all these women constantly. He's having them fight constantly. There's just too much going on. People can't take it. Everyone's tired. Everyone's tired but this guy, because he's basically...
Sounds like Mongoose running his role-playing games. all his players.
Okay. Thank you for the compliment. But basically, Gilgamesh, he's this guy, he's driving his people too hard. He's going too hard, going ham all the time. People can't take it. So they cry out to the gods and they're like, bros, help us. So the gods were like, you know what the solution to this is? We're going to make a crazy hairy man, and he's going to be a match for Gilgamesh, and his name is Enkidu. And so Enkidu, he sort of found by this hunter who they have Enkidu have sex with this prostitute, which goes for 7 days straight. That's actually literal. That's in there. A lot of weird stuff in this story.
It sounds like one of those like boomer fantasy books, like, yeah, then my guy,
it's not even like a boomer. It's more like a, it's more like an incredibly like over the top anime when you read it. Is like a doujin plot. Like,
gotcha.
Yeah. Like I'm pretty sure I heard about this in the Monster Girl Encyclopedia, people having sex for 7 days straight. Yeah, that's in there. Enkidu's a monster boy, actually, kind of.
Oh,
because he lives with the beasts. He's like a beast man. Mm. He's a hairy man, wild man.
He's the harem protagonist.
And maybe. Well, the harem protagonist isn't in Gilgamesh. There's no like lame generic character.
Okay.
I mean, they're like side, like they're like randos that don't matter, but there's not like a lame generic main character. Both Enkidu and Gilgamesh are kind of interesting thematically.
Right.
So Enkidu goes to Uruk, him and Gilgamesh hang out, and they fight each other, and they keep fighting, and then like they kind of just like, well, we can't beat each other because neither of us is actually truly stronger than the other. So they decide to do the anime thing where it's like we both beat the shit out of each other. Now we're best friends.
Hmm. Okay.
I told you this was an anime.
That's not just an anime thing, though.
Yeah, like, I know. Well, it's not just an anime thing, because this predates anime by several thousand years, but still.
This is a very male thing, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's perennial theming. That's kind of the recurring theme of the Epic of Gilgamesh, is like everything is there. This is like sort of the most basic perennial themes we have. And so continuing here, we have so then they go to fight. Gilgamesh goes and hunts this magical beast, which makes the gods angry. Everyone except for Ishtar. Ishtar decides to... She comes to Gilgamesh, and she's like, please marry me. And Gilgamesh is like, shut the fuck up, thought. So he patrols her. That makes her really mad. So the gods make a magic beast because Ishtar threatens to have a bitch fit if they don't. And... because she really wants Gilgamesh. It doesn't work out for her, though. So then Enkidu and Gilgamesh kill the beast, but the beast ends up killing Enkidu, and there's this long, drawn-out thing about Enkidu's deathbed thoughts and curses and blessings. And then there's a portion where Gilgamesh sort of is forced to reflect upon his own mortality, and he's sort of humbled by this. So then he goes on a quest to find immortality. So he finds this guy who lived through what essentially is the biblical flood. Like, the story that's told is almost exactly the same as the biblical flood story, just with different names.
But isn't that proof then that the Bible made it all, just took it from the Gilgamesh?
No, it's proof that the flood happened, you fucking libtard.
Yeah.
Libtard owned.
Yes. So he goes and finds Noah from the Bible, and Noah takes him up and down this river until they find this magic flower that Gilgamesh like dives down and grabs, and they're on the boat, and a snake steals the flower, and ultimately Gilgamesh's quest is for naught. And sort of the ultimate thing about the story is it's a perennial story, and it dwells upon these theme. It dwells upon important themes like patrolling thoughts, having good bros that you're friends with, hentai tags, and the most important theme of the story, I think, ultimately is the sort of inevitability of death, which is a recurring motif in the story, from the beginning to the end, and that's sort of interesting. And the reason that people are sort of captivated by this myth, and sort of derivations of it and things that are similar to it, isn't necessarily because it's the oldest story known to mankind, but the reason it's so enduring is ultimately because it draws on those perennial themes, which is what makes it great. And I think that's a great lesson for any storyteller to kind of think about, is when you're telling stories, there are a lot of perennial themes and mechanisms that a lot of modern storytelling and sort of the meta theory around it kind of dwells on this idea that, like, tropes are bad, generic mm-hmm. things are bad, but ultimately these things draw on these perennial sort of ideas and themes that have been repeated over and over and over again, which they have because they're effective.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I think that what's really bad is a story that lacks context, right? Like a story that lacks a connection to these perennial themes,
right? And that's why, like, stories that try to subvert all the norms are ultimately sort of, like, pointless, right? Like, that's where you get, like, the J.R.R. Tolkien versus George R.R. Martin kind of thing, is like Tolkien went and saw the First World War, which was, like, one of the greatest charnel houses in human history, lived through the Somme. And his takeaway from that was that there is a definite need for the perennial themes of heroism, brotherhood, love, hope, tragedy, and death, right? These sorts of things that mankind has been telling stories about over and over and over again from the first recorded story in human history, the Epic of Gilgamesh, right? Like, these things can repeat themselves. George R.R. Martin draft dodged the Vietnam War, another one of the 20th century's great charnel houses. And his takeaway from living his comfy boomer existence in America was that these themes ought to be cast away, that they're worthless, that they have nothing to show to people, and that the reality of life is naught but squalor and nihilism.
And tax cuts.
Oh,
and
God.
Aragorn's tax policy.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think that's the lesson you have to dwell on. If you're looking to be a game master and you're looking to tell these types of stories, you really need to think about and interface with these perennial things that human stories have always grappled with. And that is ultimately, it's not even that's how you do a good job. That's ultimately your duty as a storyteller, is to reinterpret and recontextualize these perennial sorts of ideas continuously, as we've always done. That's the big takeaway. So that's my book report.
Do you have any advice or suggestions on how somebody who's just, like, going from, you know, we play D&D with the boys, then might consider, like, integrating this kind of stuff into his plot making or world building or anything like that?
Well, D&D would actually, the kinds of games it's designed to run would actually almost dovetail extremely well with the type of storytelling in the Epic of Gilgamesh, where it's essentially bouts of people fighting each other, separated by bouts of sort of heroic dialogue and monologue. And one way to do that is to give the party NPCs to empathize with and explore those things with them through their relationship with those NPCs. If you want to explore death and its inevitability, it's not always very easy to orchestrate a tragic player death, which I would say, if you're doing that for story reasons, just don't. It very rarely comes off effectively, and it's very difficult to pull off.
I would also say talk to the player beforehand, because they might be on board with that. But if you spring it on them as a surprise...
Well, you can actually... If you have a group that's ready to engineer that kind of a story, you can. But for the most part, it's very difficult to do.
Yeah, and if you try to spring it on him as a surprise and then go, well, wasn't Bob's death moving? And he's like, I didn't want him to die, though. Like,
yeah, I didn't want my guy to die. Please don't do this, Game Master.
I had so many XP.
Yeah, but you can give the party an NPC. Perhaps this NPC, say you're playing with three characters and, you know, it's a D&D game. They're missing a cleric, right? And so you have an NPC cleric, right? A game master player character. Make this person someone that they can like. Give them a reason to sort of like this person. Maybe make them like a bro, a total like, you know, one of the boys. And it, give them that relationship. Make it mechanical. Make it beneficial. Then to illustrate that theme of death, you can take that away from them. Have them fight without the cleric a while and sort of accentuate that. Give them this this idea, right? And then you might even have the character come back or someone like the character come back. You know, like Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, how he like dies with the Balrog and the Fellowship has to deal without Gandalf for a while. And then he comes back and it's all great. But again, these things repeat themselves and there are multiple ways to do it. And you can sort of do that through a lot of different avenues.
Well, and to speak on the Gandalf example there, Gandalf, this has been commented on, much like Aragorn's tax policy, about Gandalf's, you know, like Jesus-like resurrection, right? He was brought back, and he specifically says this, I think in the movie, and I think in the book too, he was specifically brought back at the turning of the tide, right? At this point, the book was constantly down, right? Like everything had gotten worse and worse and worse until Gandalf appeared, and that was the turning where everything started to get better.
Yeah, it was the battle of, it was Helm's Deep, and Gandalf shows up with the, what was it, the Rohirrim or something?
Yeah, the rider. And they
ride down the hill, and there's that great like dun dun, or it's like it that the dun dun, dun, like the music swells, and they ride down, and they kill the orcs, and it's great.
And that's when America joined World War I.
Well, but not just that point though, but right before then, you know, they were in the woods, and I'm pretty sure, you know, they were constantly surrounded by orcs. They were looking for their friends. They had no idea where their friends were, and they were completely lost. And Gandalf just comes back and immediately puts them on the right path. Right?
Yeah, he appears to them there too. Yeah, yeah.
And they go to Rohan, and he frees the king from the grip of Saruman. And then we have the Battle of Helm's Deep. Right. So. I mean, just a small portion of that story, the party is alone in the woods. They have no idea where they are. They have no idea where they're going. And such a small little like point in that direction completely turns the story around and everything. You know, it's those kinds of literary fulcrum points, right, that you can work into your story as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. I like that. Mm-hmm. Well said, Jack.
Yeah, well, these things are perennial themes, and they crop up in the great stories over and over and over again. Like, we could just sit here endlessly and say, well, if we want to talk about the theme of death and rebirth, we can, you know, start at the Bible and then go through every
we could look at Catelyn Stark in Game of Thrones, and she was
Yeah, we could.
I knew that would get you.
We could talk about Obi-Wan Kenobi in the original Star Wars movie.
Oh, no.
I'm not even kidding. Like, that's actually the original.
You're right.
Episode 4 is a good movie.
Yep.
I will die on this hill. It's a good movie.
Yeah, you're right.
And Obi-Wan is a great character. Like, that's par excellence. Like, that's good character writing, good backstory, like, good, like, foreshadowing, backshadowing, like, world-building. It's all... Obi-Wan Kenobi is an excellent... But again, these things are perennial, and every well-written story will have them in it.
Your favorite... And because of Ahsoka, he even had a monster girl waifu.
Based!
Wait, what?
Monster girl waifus are also perennial.
Yes.
I
was joking about Ahsoka.
I have a book on my shelf of Irith mythology, and there's a guy in there who marries a mermaid. So yeah, monster girls are one of those perennial overarching themes. So bring it full circle. So you really, like, if you're looking to seek to explore, like, the Indo-Aryan, Indo-European sort of, like, perennial mythos and the themes there, you can't do it properly unless you're going to, like, have monster girl waifus. Like, those are just as important as the themes of death, rebirth, hyperboreanism, heroism, brotherhood, etc. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's just the way it is. I don't make the rules. I just tell you what they
are. Monster girls are tropes, and if you think tropes are bad, you're cringe.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. All right. So until next time, this is Little Wars. Anything but monster girls is cringe.
I approve this message.
Of course you do. This is a great message. Yeah. If you don't approve this message, you're cringe. So, yeah. Anyway, if you're listening to this on any website but littlewars.home.blog, you should go to littlewars.home.blog. There you can find everything we do, pretty much. Blog posts, link to other posts, stuff like that. We also post pretty regularly on Exodus Americanus, so you're probably listening from there as well, or Right Wing Entertainment Squads. But definitely do make sure to find us on littlewars.home.blog. That's our central source for all our things. You can find our contact information if you want to reach out to us in the show notes. We do try to respond to emails with semi-regularity and try to keep up with things. And we do read our comments and we do appreciate them. So again, thank you and thank you for joining us. We're sorry this is a little late, but sometimes circumstances get in the way. We hope it was worth the wait. And remember, keep your balls cold, stay creative, and everything but monster girls are cringe. See ya.
See ya.
See ya.
This is a good sign off.
Keep your balls cold. Oh, God damn it.
Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of Little Wars. For more traditional gaming autism, head over to littlewars.home.blog. That's Little Wars, all together, no spaces, .home.blog. Have a great week, and many epic gamer moments. That first shame on my father.